The Napoleonic Era, Napoleon in Exile, 1815 to 1821. Napoleon observed. When Napoleon was on the HMS Bellerophon's deck, excepting those that he asked to walk with him, the members of his entourage followed him at a respectable distance, with the men being bareheaded. No one spoke unless first addressed by Napoleon. Before long, the English also adopted these manners in his presence. If you read the writings of the ship's crew, no one disapproved of Napoleon's actions. The crew took their cue from Captain Maitland, who saw that Napoleon still considered himself a royal personage, but did not dispute the point, considering that to do so would be both ungracious and uncalled for under the circumstances. Captain Maitland had Admiral Haddam's courteous treatment of Napoleon as an example. Plus, he didn't know how the British government intended to deal with his passenger. In addition, since the comportment of Napoleon's suite in no way interfered with the efficient running of his ship, Captain Maitland did nothing to discourage it. Plus, the affability, gentlemanliness, and dignity of manner and interest in things England that Napoleon constantly displayed during the voyage would have demeaned any effort to impose a more austere regimen. From the officers down to the humblest British seamen, they were all consumed by curiosity about Napoleon. For years, he had been the dominant figure in their lives, the main reason for their serving in the Royal Navy. Their actions had been directed to working for Napoleon's defeat and overthrowing. Some had even shed their blood and lost friends in battles against Napoleon's French forces. They had heard and read much about Napoleon. They talked about him among themselves. They judged him on the basis of imperfect knowledge, heavily tinged with the prejudices fed by war propaganda. You read any of the English newspapers, and they have all sorts of stories. You know, he's bony. He's all sorts of different things. I even have a couple of private English newspapers. One of them is called the Anti-Gallican Monitor. This man is just anti-French, anti-Napoleon, and it's just his ranting and ravings on what he disliked and what was going on. And of course, he makes his money by selling advertisements and trying to get information on POWs that the French are holding. So it's pretty brutal out there. Now, they could, of course, the crew should now scrutinize the Corsican ogre, as he was also called, at first hand. Not a man amongst the Bellerophon crew knew it, but each in his own way had been assigned by fate a part in one of history's singular episodes. The men eagerly gathered every possible personal detail about Napoleon, storing them against the days when gathered around their hearths or in a public inn or in the barracks with other troops or, for that matter, on the forecastles of other ships, they could regale their audiences with stories of the day when they rubbed elbows with Napoleon. And quite a few wrote accounts that have survived to us. For example, here's one. Napoleon is about 5 feet 7 inches high, rather corpulent, remarkably well made. His hair is very black, cut close, whiskers shaved off, large eyebrows, gray eyes, the most piercing I ever saw, rather full face, dark but peculiar complexion, his nose and mouth proportionate, broad shoulders, and apparently strongly built. Upon the whole, he's a good-looking man. And when young, must have been handsome. He appears about 45 to 46, his real age, greatly resembles the different prints that I have seen of him from London. His teeth were finely set and white as ivory, and his mouth had a charm about it that I've never seen in any other human countenance. His limbs, particularly well formed, with a fine ankle. It's really hilarious to see a fine ankle. The very, very small foot, which he seemed rather vain. His hands were also very small and had plumpness of a woman's rather than the robustness of a man's. His hair was very dark brown, nearly approaching black, and though a little thin on top in the front, had not gray amongst it. And then this third account, we were always sure of a sight of the emperor and the chief part of his suite immediately after dinner, when he generally remained on deck for about half an hour. Lady Bertrand, Captain Maitland, Bertrand, Savary, Le Monde, Las Casas, and his aide-de-camp Montholon formed the principal figures of the group that was ranged around the emperor. While us young gentlemen took up our station on the poop to feast our eyes with the sight of the great man, whose name had been sounded in our ears since we seemingly drew our first breath, and become, like a second nature to us, a name of fear, he generally kept his gold snuff box in hand while in conversation with these family groups, taking a pinch quite in a homely way. But I never saw him offer it to anyone else. Neither did I ever observe him use it while walking the decks by himself, or when in an earnest conversation with any of his suite individually. Notwithstanding that, we have him invariably drawn and busted with his arms folded across his breast. I never saw him in that attitude, but once during the whole 3 weeks we had him on board. His most common posture was his right hand stuck into his breast waistcoat or thrust into the breeches pocket while he held the snuff box in the other. And then there's a fourth one, the final one. His walk is a march, or as far as a sailor may be allowed to judge, very like one. And to complete the portrait, I must add that in walking, he generally carries his hands in the pockets of his pantaloons are folded behind his back. Now, it's interesting to note that they're making it, a couple of them talk about how they have viewed him in either art or in drawings and on magazines or newspapers with the folded arms and the scowling. And of course, having read many, many, many biographies, his business of both hands behind his back and walking is very common. Of course, the hand inside the jacket we have in portraits, which he tends to do very common. But it was interesting to see how these men noticed, particularly the one with the small hands and the women-like hands type of thing. But he got the height right, 5'7" tall. So it's interesting to see how you get these. And again, when these guys got older, you know, and sit down to tell those kind of stories, yeah, I was there on the ship when Napoleon surrendered to us. At any rate, getting back to what was going on, from the quarter deck or the orlop deck, the interest and conversation of the crew centered on what Napoleon and his companions looked like, said, what they'd eaten that day, and some of the ship's company were well aware of this historic importance. And as I've read, you've got all kinds of the examples. And of course, we've got letters from other people, the people on, well, not St. Helena, but on, well, there are some of those, obviously, but Elba and other places that you get to see this part. And you're going to find out that once the ship sets in the port there in England, then the ship is just mobbed with everything that can possibly carry people as they come out the seam and shout and do all sorts of other stuff. So it's interesting to see how he works the crew and works to the people. Now we'll have to see what's going to happen when we get to the government. Now, the sources for this, 50 Days, Napoleon in England by Duhamel, Napoleon After Waterloo by Thornton, and Napoleon St. Helena by Gilbert Martineau. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, don't forget to come by the website, SummaHistorica.com or HistoryAccordingToBob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out the CDs, which of course can be sent to you electronically on a USB port. And if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.